Geekscape.com.
The Races of America, Part 2. The Spanish Conquest of America. The first landing of the Spanish adventurers was on the islands, where they made considerable settlements before the conquest of the mainland was undertaken by Hernando Cortes and his companions. They found these islands thinly inhabited by natives, apparently even more primitive, peaceful, and docile than those of the continent. They made but a feeble resistance to the conquerors, but the Spanish lust for gold was so fierce and unsparing that they loaded them down with heavy burdens in the mines and on the plantations, and finally drove them into a resistance that rapidly destroyed these innocent and helpless creatures. After the discovery that Negroes were vastly more available for tropical labour, the natives, save that their lands were taken from them, were left to shift for themselves. But the pressure of the European race, even when no longer loading them down with burdens, was fatal to them, and except in Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Dominica, they have entirely disappeared from the islands. There is a considerable infusion of Indian blood in the Spanish portion of San Domingo, and even in Cuba, but in Jamaica, Barbados, indeed all the other West Indian islands, the native element is wholly extinct. There were several efforts, unsuccessfully made, to penetrate the mainland, but it remained for Cortes to accomplish this enterprise, and thus to figure in history as the chief and leader of the most romantic and wonderful adventure that ever had been undertaken in the world's history. Jason's search for the Golden Fleece, Alexander's invasion of India, indeed, the then recent crusades after the Holy Sepulchre, were all dimmed and dwarfed to the European mind when contrasted with this mysterious and wonderful conquest of a new world. A new world, vast regions, mighty populations, great empires, and great cities were suddenly opened to the old world by a mere handful of Spanish heroes, and great and mighty as he was, Charles V felt no doubt that even Emperor of Germany and King of Spain were titles that paled before the splendours of this magnificent empire of the Indies conferred upon him by Cortes and his brave companions. The bare conception of such an undertaking, the bold adventure into a new and mysterious region without any knowledge of it or of the people they were going to contend with, certainly render Cortes's expedition a very grand one, and viewed from the European standpoint, impressed the old world with awe at its hardihood quite as much as it did the young and enterprising with its romance and mystery. But aside from this, and regarded simply as a matter of fact, it was less difficult and called into action less heroism and endurance than a thousand other things that have happened in history. 500 Spaniards, under the command of Cortes, landed on the coast near the present Veracruz, and after some explorations into the interior, not only refused to obey the commands of the governor of Cuba and return to that island, but burned his ships, it is said, to prevent any of his followers from deserting him. He had some dozen or so small pieces of artillery, 80 cavalry, covered with mail, and indeed his infantry, were so protected that the native weapons were harmless against them, and therefore, whatever the dangers of the enterprise, from want of food, fatigue, or wandering in unknown deserts, every man of his command knew that his life was safe from the weapons of the enemy. This gave a courage to them that never despaired, and as the natives had never seen horses before, when they were confronted by the wonderful and awe-inspiring creatures, for they mistook the horse and his rider for centaurs, they were overwhelmed with terror. Indeed, the Spanish infantry, those gods who had come from an unknown world, with their fair skins and flowing beards and majestic presence, impressed the simple natives with profound awe, and when Cortes ordered up his artillery and fired a general salute, they fell flat upon their faces, as if all the demons of their own monster religion had spoken at once. He first built a fort, and in Yankee fashion, laid out a town on the coast, and then, after well protecting his rear, began that romantic march, which, after many difficulties and some disasters, terminated in the capture of the so-called capital of Mexico, and the establishment of the Spanish dominion in the New World. It was a long and weary march over burning plains, mighty mountain ranges, vast chasms, and deep and rapid rivers, and a perpetual battle from the commencement to the end of it, though few Spaniards lost their lives in actual combat. It was substantially over the same route that Scott followed 300 years later, and in some respects the two marches were very much alike, although the latter was probably the more difficult. Cortes was marching into an unknown and mysterious region, had to make his own roads and provide his troops with food, without being able to see any end or conclusion of his expedition, but save the fatigue of killing the enemy in his front and all about him, there was no danger from the arms of that enemy. Even his repulse and retreat after entering Mexico, with all the horrors of the famous Noche Triste, was the result of mere overwhelming numbers, forcing them back by sheer physical force, and without any, or at all events, with slight loss of life. The simple unarmed natives, for their arms were utterly useless when confronted with these mailed Spaniards, could do little even in checking the march of Cortes, and the fatigue and want of food, and the uncertainties always before them, rendered that march painful and difficult, and called out all the high capabilities of courage and endurance, which in those times so eminently distinguished the Spanish people. Spain was then at the head of European civilization, the greatest power of the day, and though largely mixed with the Goths, probably was more legitimately the descendants of the Romans than any other European people. There never has been since such a grand manifestation of what our race is capable of as that displayed by Republican Rome. There were, it is true, many repulsive features in the Roman civilization, many things that are even abhorrent to Christian minds, but with all their defects, there was a grandeur of soul and a development of individual manhood that has never been excelled since. The Spaniards of the 15th century retained more of the high qualities of these grand old Romans than any other people of their time, and Cortes and Pizarro and Ponce de Leon and other conquerors of the New World often approximated to the Roman standard. Nevertheless, the conquest of Mexico by Scott was a more difficult undertaking than that of Cortes, and if we could separate or leave out the mystery, the uncertainty, in a word, the unknown, and compare the actual alone, all would no doubt assent to this opinion. Scott had to deal with the same people, trained in the channels of European civilization, and led and officered by white men, or by those of predominating white blood, almost without exception. The rank and file were Indians, but the officers were mainly white men, and among them Santa Anna, Arista Diaz, and all the leading chiefs opposed to Scott were not only typical Caucasians, but thoroughly educated and accomplished soldiers, differing in no respect whatever from those of France, England, or the United States. They had, moreover, all the perfect appliances of modern warfare, all the fortifications, castles, and strong defences erected by their former Spanish masters, and in the face of all this, Scott cut his way to the capital, and with only 10,000 men, entered the Valley of Mexico in no less than half of the time consumed by Cortes in the 15th century. No European power could have done this. No people but Americans could have accomplished the work of Scott and his army within that period, and with such means at their disposal, the proof of which the world has seen since in the recent invasion of the French, the bravest and most warlike nation in Europe. The cause of this American superiority is obvious. It was that high sense of manhood that springs from juxtaposition with subordinate races and impels them to look with disdain on the latter when confronted in battle. The European, dwarfed and degraded by factitious and unnatural distinctions of class, loses half of his native manhood, and perpetually reminded of his inferiority to others, or some others, is incapable of that glorious sentiment of democracy, which while it recognizes equals, it cannot even form a conception of anything, save the Almighty Creator, superior to itself. This was a spirit that marched and conquered with Scott in Mexico, for though the rank and file of the old army were in no respect superior to the rank and file of European armies, it was the American esprit de corps, or the so-called slave-holding spirit of the officers, that gave impulse and character to the Mexican War and rendered that army so grand and irresistible. How could it be otherwise? Here they were, confronted, not by Negroes, it is true, but by a race of men closely approximating to our own subordinate race, and to retreat or fall back, or under any circumstances to permit the inferior Mexicans to challenge them, or indeed to resist or obstruct their path, could not be tolerated for a moment. The European, ignorant of race and degraded by caste, would fancy that these black, yellow, or brown men were thus different from themselves, from the same causes that rendered them inferior to other classes. But the American, with that instinct of race to guide him, with the natural sense of superiority over these Indians, Negroes, or hybrids, was impelled by nature herself to assert his supremacy and to drive them from his path. Cortes and his companions had more of the ancient spirit of Roman democracy in them than any other Europeans of that day, and it is probable that Englishmen, Frenchmen, or Germans would have been incapable of that conquest of Mexico. But be this as it may, it is certain that no Europeans could have done what Scott and his army accomplished in our own times in Mexico. It was the first instance in our history when the full esprit de corps, the complete development of American democracy, was manifested, that grand sense of American manhood, which, springing from the instincts of superiority, tolerates nothing superior to itself, save heaven alone, and which, however maimed or disabled at this moment, must rule the continent. After the capture of Mexico, and the death of the supposed Montezuma, numerous other expeditions were fitted out, and gradually the whole country, from Florida to Brazil, brought under the Spanish dominion. There was a great amount of romance and adventure in these conquests, a great extent of suffering, trial, and exposure endured by the conquerors as well as the conquered. When they had succeeded, as did Pizarro in Peru and Vasco de Nuñez in Central America, they quarrelled with each other, plotted, intrigued, and assassinated their chiefs, or revolted against them and seized the supreme power. The earlier conquests, like those of Pizarro, were simple enough, though they endured great hardships from the long and dreary marches and want of food. The natives could make no resistance against forces so terribly armed and secured in armour, and save in those cases where sheer numbers overwhelmed and, as it were, overlaid the Spaniards, they fell an easy, almost unresisting conquest to the adventurers. But after a while, they learned the use of arms, and in some instances it required many years and immense efforts to subdue some of the mountain tribes. Indeed, there are some tribes or nations still unsubdued to this day. The general ignorance of the extent and character of the countries conquered was such that though it was almost in their neighbourhood, many years elapsed before they discovered the Pacific Ocean. Bilboa, who has the credit of this discovery, well illustrates the Spanish character of that day. He is said to have equipped himself in full armour, and riding his horse into the waves as far as possible, drew his sword, and with a grand flourish took possession of the sea in the name of the King of Spain, and challenged the world there and then to dispute it if they dared. It was equally characteristic of the English of that day, when Blake, Elizabeth's great admiral, fell on his knees and gave thanks to God for this grand discovery of a new ocean as well as a new continent. What were the numbers of the native population at the time of the Spanish conquest? It is difficult to determine or even to conjecture. It has been represented by English writers, and indeed by the Spaniards themselves, that this population was almost countless, and that millions of them perished in a vain resistance against the conquerors. But this is altogether incredible. Their original resistance was very feeble, and as there could be no motive for a wanton slaughter of these feeble and innocent people, it is unreasonable to suppose that such occurred to any considerable extent. The probabilities are, therefore, that there has been but little change in this respect, and that the native population is now quite as large as it ever was, or at all events, there was but slight destruction of the natives within the Spanish conquest. The case is entirely different in the northern or British colonies, where radically different circumstances have rapidly destroyed the natives, and which, if not changed, must finally annihilate them altogether. But within the Spanish line of conquests, there probably has been but little change in this respect, save in the islands, where the introduction of the Negro, far more than the burdens imposed on them by the Spaniards, destroyed the natives. There is absolutely no reliable data on this subject, and as the conquest was easily and rapidly effected, and there could be no motive or interest whatever in wanton slaughter, it is most likely that the native element, with all the drawbacks of amalgamation, is larger now than ever before. But it may be asked, why, when Asia had 300 million Mongols, and even Africa, with all its burdens of amalgamation and losses by deportation, has 60 million Negroes, this continent should have only 15 or 20 million people? This may not be answered. The starting point of the human creation can never be known to mortals, for if so, they would be just what the devil promised Eve, and as wise as the Almighty Creator himself. We know, and are only permitted to know, our own nature and wants, and our specific relations to the lower races, and we should reverently accept the work of God as it is, and adapt our institution to it, without any vain and indeed impious effort to comprehend the secret counsels of omnipotence. Nor should we wonder at the long delay, the innumerable ages this continent was undiscovered, and the comparative waste or loss of its mighty products so essential to human welfare, the uses of which have so vitally affected modern civilization. For after all, these things are but trifles in the grand drama of human destiny, and thousands or millions of years are as but a day or moment to the almighty maker and ruler of the universe. But while the mere physical conquest of the Spanish adventurers was rapidly and easily effected, the moral conquest was vastly more difficult, and just here is the radical difference between the Spanish dominion and that of the English adventurers in North America. To this day, we have made no moral conquest of the native tribes, and therefore have simply destroyed them, while Spain not only conquered the natives, but vastly benefited them, and at the same time rendered them an essential element in the civilization of the continent. It was the Church that truly conquered the natives of Spanish America, and without which all that Cortes, Pizarro, and their companions did would have been totally fruitless in the settlement and civilization of these vast regions. It is not proposed to discuss the relative merits of Catholicism and Protestantism. Perhaps the latter is vastly better adapted to the spiritual wants of our own race, but it is certain that the former can alone deal successfully with the subordinate races of mankind. It is not necessary to lug in the silly and hypocritical assertion that all men are of one blood to render Christianity available with the lower races of mankind. Weak women and little children often become the noblest exemplars of Christian doctrine, and so with Mongols, Indians, and Negroes. When applied to them as such, Mongols, Indians, and Negroes become truly Christian and useful and happy beings. This is what the Catholic Church did. She applied her church discipline to the actual nature and real wants of these subordinate creatures, and was thus successful in civilizing a continent. Her priests marched with the conquerors, and as soon as the physical defeat took place, they took moral charge of the defeated. For them they braved, indeed sought, martyrdom, and they who found it were regarded as the favored of heaven. Strange paradox. At the very moment, unless all modern history is at fault, the Church in the old world was at the very acme of corruption and rottenness. Her priests in the new world were the most pure, devoted, and perfect ever known in her history. Indeed, there is no parallel in the history of Christianity. No such body of earnest, pure, and devoted men was ever seen before as that body of churchmen who followed the Spanish adventurers to America. This earnest and single-minded devotion made a profound impression on the native mind, an impression that has brought the native within the circle of modern civilization, and that has been ever since the conquest the main, if not sole, moral influence over the native masses. Spain, soon after the success of the adventurers, sent over her viceroys, and the grand work of Christianizing the natives and civilizing a continent began. The natives, as fast as conquered, were parceled out among the conquerors with the lands they occupied. The Spanish soldiers that followed Cortes, Pizarro, and other chiefs were, even in the rank and file, gentlemen, that is, were rarely of the peasant or working class, and however deficient in what in these times is called education, they were all regarded as equals, and in the distribution of the conquered natives, the sole difference that was recognized was military service in the conquest. The lands were distributed in much the same way, and some of the most distinguished chiefs had whole provinces conferred upon them, as well as many thousand natives. But there was great difficulty. The mere physical conquest, though seemingly complete, was soon found to be precarious and not unfrequently dangerous to the conquerors. the rude and ferocious soldier, governing his work animals by force, by the lash, by bloodhounds, and all the physical appliances of brute machinery, failed to render them profitable, even where they were not dangerous. The Negro alone, of all the human races, can be thus governed. He is so vastly inferior to the white man, such an absolute mental and moral blank, in a word, is so entirely a child race, that he never resists, indeed, so naturally and instinctively seeks the rule of the master race, that force is quite unnecessary. But the beneficent Creator has so adapted this weak and helpless Negro that his very weakness is a protection and security against the avarice of his master, who soon understood that no extent of lash, of brutality or cruelty can get any more work out of him than is legitimate and proper. There is a passive, stolid, and unexpected resistance in the Negro organism, which every planter and overseer understands, that resists all efforts to overwork him, and saves him from that pitiful stiffness of joint and muscle which excessive toil has so stamped upon the working classes of our own kind in the old world. But unlike the Negro, the native has a certain character to be understood and overawed, a specific nature, capable of a certain development, as explained elsewhere, and which enabled the Aztecs and other tribes in the centre of this continent to reach the condition in which they were found by the Spaniards. This specific character, the mere physical conquest could not reach. They might exterminate them, as did the English adventurers in the north, but they needed their labour and could not afford the luxury of extermination. But the Church interposed and performed this conquest over the natives, a conquest that all the mighty power of Spain and all Europe to back her would have been unable to accomplish otherwise. As has been said, the priest marched with the soldier, indeed not unfrequently outstripped him, and sought martyrdom among the fiercer tribes, and from the beginning he was as universally regarded as the protector as the soldier was the oppressor of these people. This profound impression on the native mind enabled the Church not only to civilize them, but to harmonize the natives with their masters and to organize society on a basis that, with all the changes, mutations, and horrors since enacted in Spanish America, to a certain extent exists still. A Spaniard owned all the land for 50 miles, perhaps, with 20,000 to 50,000 natives subject to him, or that were assigned to him by the viceroy. He built a grand house, or hacienda, surrounded by a strong wall, 20 feet high, within which were his horses, all his immediate valuables, and his guards, usually vicious and worthless Spaniards, but more often hybrids or mongrels. The Indians, collected in villages, were close by, though when the populations were sparse, sometimes these villages were totally unknown, save by the priest and the alcaldes erected by the master. It was at a time when religious belief was deep and sincere, indeed when the Pope himself was even more anxious to Christianize than the Spanish princes were to conquer the New World. Churches were erected, the people baptized, sometimes in thousands, and with all their lust of gold and stern hardiness of character, the early Spanish adventurers were themselves profoundly religious. The nature or discipline of the Catholic Church, capable of such elasticity as to include or permit of its adaptation to every form or condition of human existence, was just what seemed needed to the moral conquest of the lower races of mankind, and it did a missionary work in America that not only has no parallel in Protestant history, but that, in the very nature of things, is forever impossible to the latter. How far this might be carried without the prior physical conquest as a preparation, there are no means of knowing. But in this instance, and acting in concert with the Spanish civil authorities, the Catholic Church was truly the civilizer of a new world, and rendered millions of otherwise useless and wandering barbarians useful and happy members of Christian and civilized society. There was no effort to open schools and educate them into something else than that which God had made them, to force them to manifest the faculties or fill the role of white men. But as even New England does with women and children, the church, accepting them as they were, in fact a different and subordinate species of humankind, and treated them accordingly. Of course, the priests, in dealing with these subordinate people, did not depart in theory from the absurd dogma of one blood, or a single race so universal with Europeans, nor did they, in theory or formally, abandon any of the orthodox dogmas of the church itself, but in their practical treatment of the natives, they were in entire harmony with the laws of nature, and regarded them as they were, and are, and must be forever, short of a new creation, a distinctly different and subordinate species of man. Hence was their success, and as observed, they did what the whole power of Spain, and all Europe besides, was unable to do. They effected a moral conquest of the natives, and civilized many millions of people. Churches and convents were erected all over the land, from Florida to Brazil, and schoolhouses too, as far as was needed or useful. The conflicts between the Spanish adventurer and the natives assigned to him by the Spanish government or viceroy were harmonized and settled by the church, which always and under all circumstances was regarded by all parties as the protector of the natives. The system, if system it may be called, which regulated the relations of the land proprietor with the conquered natives assigned him, is almost indescribable, indeed differed in many respects in the districts of the several captain generalships that the vast regions of the Spanish dominions were divided into. There was little, if any, resemblance to what by an absurd misnomer is called slavery in our own southern states. Indians are specifically different from Negroes. The whole Mexican, Central and South American region is radically different from ours, and beyond these natural differences, there are the artificial differences of Spanish and English and Catholic and Protestant, which in the tout ensemble, of course, renders comparison impossible. The vast regions south of our own consist of alternate mountain ranges with no capacity of cultivation and valleys overflowing with vegetation, so that small plantations or anything approaching even to an agricultural life like ours seems out of the question. The lands, therefore, were given to comparatively few, and though a considerable number of Spanish emigrants came from Spain, they confined themselves to the towns, and rarely had any connection with agriculture. This was carried on by the great proprietors, or their managers, and the Indian labourers, but the moral force of the church was the essential agency, both in preparing the natives in the first instance for the uses of civilization, and in preserving peace and harmony at all times between the proprietor and his people.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.